Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, what if our understanding of weight loss and diabetes, obesity lied not in how our stomachs and mouths work, but actually how our brains work? Well, scientists have revealed a groundbreaking map of the hypothalamus, the brain's control center for weight and appetite. Joining me to talk to me about his work is Professor Giles Yeo. He's a professor of molecular neuroendocrinology at the University of Cambridge. He's also honorary president of the British Dietetic Association. Welcome to the program, Giles. It's been a while since we've had you. Can I ask you, what is the hypothalamus and why is it of interest to us particularly?
So the hypothalamus, for those of you who don't know where it is, most of you, imagine the bridge of your nose and go into the center of the brain from the bridge of your nose, and it sits right above a part of the brain called the pituitary. And human beings is the size of your thumbnail, the shape of an almond. Within the context of body weight, it acts as a fuel sensor. So your brain senses long-term signals from your fat, how much fat you have, and your brain also signals what you've just eaten. And that is the part of the brain which senses this. So it's the brain, it's the sensing part, the fuel sensor of your brain.
And this is an area of great interest for lots of different reasons, not just dietary, right?
Not just dietary. I mean, it also plays a role, for example, in reproduction. So it plays a big role in setting timing of puberty, menopause. It plays a big role in circadian rhythms. Is it, you know, when what happens when you work shifts? It plays a big role in regulating your thirst, amount of salt. It does a lot of things on homeostasis, which means the balance of your body. But within the concept of body weight, it's a fuel sensor.
So what exactly was this research about? It's a sort of like a GPS for the hypothalamus. Hypo map. What is that?
The hypo map is the map of the hypothalamus. Look, I'm for all the highfalutin names that I have, I'm a glorified cartographer. So I make, in effect, I made the map here. Most of these circuits have been understood, at least prior to this particular map, have been understood typically from animal models and largely as mice. For the reason that we can't get into the brain of a living human being legally or ethically, certainly. But I think there's been leaps in technology in terms of what we can do, as well as access to brain donor samples. Slightly morbid, but that's what we do. We work with brain donor samples that we'll now be able to put together the technology, as well as now increasing access to these donor samples to make these maps. But everything prior to this, I mean, it's like landing on the moon. Like, we know next to nothing about the human brain, certainly this part of the human brain. Everything we've known prior to this has been from animals.
So when we talk about a map, because we hear this all the time, we're mapping the brain. What exactly does that mean? I mean, is it the one neuron connection to another? Is it an electrical map of signals? Is it chemical neurotransmission? What exactly does a map mean?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Because these are brain donors, they are obviously not living. We can't do an electrical or a circuit map. It's very difficult. You need living tissue for that. So what we are actually mapping is the RNA, the mRNA, the messenger between your genes and the proteins. We are measuring that. But because we can measure that, first of all, at the single neuron level, one at a time, and we know everything about that, and then we can actually do it spatially. So in other words, we take slices of the brain and map them onto there. So that's what I mean. So we're not mapping the circuits per se, because you need a living creature for that, but we're mapping where the genes are expressed, and then making, and that's the map. It's the map of where the genes are expressed.
So I think it's really interesting because we talk a lot about our DNA on this program and what genes are. And if you listen to this program a lot, you probably know that genes are responsible for coding proteins and there's a bit in between the DNA and the proteins, and the proteins essentially make the stuff that is us, our bodies, our feelings, and all sorts of things to do with us. When you say you're mapping where the RNA is expressed, what do you mean by that? What does that tell us, and what does it explain about these parts of the brain?
Okay, so if you look at your DNA, it's the same in every single cell. So actually mapping that in a single cell level has no value, at least for this particular scenario, because it'd be one big homogenous, you know, color.
Be the same everywhere. Every cell would look the same.
It'd be the same everywhere. Proteins are very difficult to measure. for technical reasons. And there is no high throughput. Well, that's not true. It is very difficult to measure it, all of it at once. So what we can do is measure protein 2, 3, 4, 5 at a time. But there are 25,000 different genes. So that's a lot of time you actually take to do it. And so RNA, which converts it's sort of as a messenger between DNA and protein, is a useful intermediate because it differs between each cell, a brain cell compared to a fat cell, compared to a liver cell. So it tells you what is going to be turned into protein, broadly speaking. And you can do it at scale. So in other words, when I look at one cell, all 25,000 potential different transcripts, RNAs that are there, which you can't do with protein. We do use protein in order to find out specific proteins. Interesting genes, does it really mean the same thing for proteins as well? But you can only do proteins 5 or 6 at a time. RNA, you can do thousands at a time. That's why we look at the RNA.
And so how does this have anything to do with appetite, obesity, hunger, and being overweight?
So because we're mapping the fuel sensor, so your brain needs to know 2 pieces of information broadly in order to influence your food intake, right? It needs to understand how much fat you have because that's how long you would last without any food, okay? So it needs to know that. And it needs to know what you're currently eating and what you have just eaten. And these are going to come from your gut, your gastrointestinal, your digestive system. And all of these are hormonal. And so what your brain does is senses these long and short-term hormones and then translates this and then influences your next interaction with a menu, with a refrigerator, or with a restaurant. And so in order to understand what our brain is doing and translating with these informations, we're trying to see where the receptors for these hormones sit within the brain. One thing that is particularly relevant, and we mapped in the paper, I think the whole world suddenly knows what Ozempic is. Okay, there's this new class of weight loss and diabetes drugs. And so we map, for example, for the first time in humans, because everything prior to this, as I said, has been done in mice. We mapped for the first time where, in effect, Ozempic, or at least the source hormone, GLP-1, binds to within the hypothalamus, just as an example, and what other genes are expressed with it.
Okay, so is this similar? Because obviously Ozempic and pretty much all drugs are tested on, not all drugs just on mice, but a lot of drugs are tested on mice first. Is it exactly the same part of the mouse's brain as the human brain? When you looked at the hypothalamus, we obviously know a lot about the mouse hypothalamus. Is it pretty much the same thing, but bigger? Is GLP binding in the same way? Is the mammal a very good analog for a human in this case?
Okay, that's the $64 million question. So one of the first things we did before we started doing anything was, because we also created the mouse hypermap, but that was less interesting. And so what we did was we then compared the two, right? The mouse hypermap with the human hypermap. Broadly speaking, most of the important neuronal populations are the same between mouse and humans, which is why we use mouse as a model and which is why it's useful. But we do find some nuanced, I would say, but therapeutically relevant differences. And in particular, around where GLP-1 binds, and in particular, around how our brain senses fat, there are subtle differences in the different types of populations. And you might say, well, how subtle is subtle and why does it matter? It matters because we're chucking a load of drugs now at the hypothalamus, you know, from diabetes drugs and this drugs and that drugs. And there's a lot of things called combinatorial therapies that are currently undergoing, which means that some people are going to be too sensitive to Ozempic, and so therefore make them feel slightly pukey, right? And so maybe they need to lower the dose of Ozempic and use another drug. And we can't do that. We can't make the calls about whether or not it's likely or not likely to work without understanding, from a human-specific context, where these receptors are actually.
What's different between one patient and another?
Yeah, exactly. And so we haven't discovered. Like I said, I'm a glorified cartographer, so I'm presenting a map rather than necessarily presenting an earth-shaking discovery. But I would like to think the map will enable us to make further discoveries, because all we did within this particular, we made the map, and then we highlighted the bits that have to do with feeding. But we didn't do anything about reproduction, about stress, about daylight, about anything else. So now, and we've made the map available to the world. It's open access. Anyone can do what they want with it. And so hopefully now experts in thirst, in salt, in blood pressure, in reproduction can take the map and do something useful with it.
This is a very small part of the brain. But this map is, I'm sure, very useful for figuring out, as you say, you know, what parts of the brain are responsible, what they're doing, and how drugs might be used more effectively. What about the rest of the brain, the prefrontal cortex and the orbital cortex and all the different parts of the brain that make us who we are? How far ahead are we on mapping those? And is it miles and miles away? Because from a lot of the chatter, I get the sense that it's not, but is it miles and miles away until we have a fully functional analog of the brain?
It's going to cost a lot of money because the human brain is so big. I think we got a lot more information. I mean, recently they published an entire map, for example, of the fruit fly, but they're tiny brains. And so therefore you can see, we now have the technology. Let's put it this way. We have the technology to do it. We just need people who are experts in the regions they are. So I just happen to be an expert at the hypothalamus, which is the most ancient part of the brain and the most complex part of the brain. So we thought we'd start there. I'm also working on what we call the hindbrain. So if you consider the hypothalamus to handle hunger, the hindbrain handles the back of the brain, right where your head meets the neck. That part of the brain handles how full you are, which is different from being hungry, I just want to point out, and anywhere from being comfortably full, oh my God, I'm so full, oh my God, I'm full, I feel like puking, that whole range of things. We're doing that as well. And probably we're going to hit, begin to think about the reward part of the brain as well, but we haven't funded that yet. So I'm going to focus on the parts of the brain using the technology we have to do with food intake. But you're right. I mean, the brain is a pretty big piece of real estate. But other people who know, who are experts at the cortex or the cerebellum, you know, on hippocampus are going to need to deal with that.
Now, do you design your work that it can interface with other people's models in that way? Or when you're saying we're going to map out the hypothalamus, do you do that in a way that if someone's mapping out the prefrontal cortex or whatever, that those two can be clicked together and connected in a way?
Yes. So that's the beauty of doing RNA. Because while each of the technologies we may use may be subtly different, ultimately, when we put it, they should all click together. There is a huge, huge project at the moment in the world, and it's led by from the Sanger Institute, which is just south of here, as well as the MIT Broad in Boston. It's called the Human Cell Atlas. And there, they're trying to map every cell in the whole body. And what we're going to do is take our data and in effect, plug it into the Human Cell Atlas so that eventually when the whole thing is done, mine will be a tiny little part of the whole atlas, but that will be the bit that I did and it'll be right, oh, we did, and that'll be right there. So no, it's all designed to join in and be part of the Human Cell Atlas to benefit everyone else.
I wanted to finish asking you about the topic that comes up over and over now in the news, microplastics and their presence in the brain. Have you come across any of the presence of these microplastics in your work? Is it something that you know anything about?
So I don't know anything about it. And what we've actually looked for, RNA, means that we won't see the microplastics. However, that being said, the samples we have, for example, we can find people with obesity or what did they die of, can be used to identify the presence of microplastics. I mean, it will be quite... I make me feel slightly pukey, scared if we find microplastics within the brain. But yeah, it is a potential. The samples we have would be able to be used to actually look for those things. I'm not an expert though.
Yeah, I heard someone say that we're now looking at up to a plastic teaspoon's worth of microplastics are found in brains.
I didn't want to know that.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Well, at some point you're going to open up. You're going to see a whole lot of Lego pieces. And just finally, I suppose, in terms of practical work for your research, will we see a better versions of Wegovy and Ozempic that are more tolerable, that can be tuned as a result of understanding that the brain's interaction with our hormones?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I've seen some of the drugs that are coming down the pipeline, in various stages of trials, and they are going to make Ozempic look like a weedy boy. I mean, for example, there is a new drug right now coming on, it's still being trialed. Okay, still being trialed, so it's not released yet, which is a once monthly injection and rather than once weekly. Then we are now really working. So weekly was a game changer because people go, it's not every day. But imagine once a season, you go to the GP. That is potentially what is coming down the line.
Yeah, and of course, for people who need it, that could be an absolute game changer. Really, really interesting speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time. Professor Charles Yeo is from the University of Cambridge.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.